So, in essence, the authority of Christ is understood as being dispensed to individuals, believers, who then delegate that power to the elders who represent them. They submit or yield their powers to leaders because they view the leaders as chosen by God and whose function it is to govern and lead. Once these leaders are elected or appointed, they function in the place of or on behalf of individuals. So it is at the level of the elders that divine authority actually functions within the church. Most of the adherents of this particular system would not hold that this form of polity is the only one that can be scripturally supported from the New Testament. While during the Reformation, the Presbyterian leaders thought they were restoring the original form of church government, Presbyterians today would not hold tenaciously to this. It is held, however, that although it may not be the only scriptural form of New Testament government, it certainly is a scriptural form of polity. This authority is exercised in a series of governing assemblies. At the local level, it is the session for Presbyterians and the consistory for the Reformed that is the decision-making body. The next grouping consists of the Presbytery for Presbyterians or the classis for the Reformed, which governs all the churches in a certain geographical area. This is made up of one lay elder and one minister from each consistory or one lay elder from each session and all the ministers in the area of the Presbytery. The next grouping consists of the synod, which is made up of an equal number of lay elders and clergy chosen by each presbytery or classes. At the highest level, the Presbyterian Church has a general assembly composed of lay and clergy representatives from the presbyteries. The synod is bypassed when electing representatives to the general assembly. The presbyteries select representatives to both the synod and the General Assembly. Decisions are made by the governing bodies at each level. Their decisions are subject to review and revision by the next highest body. The prerogatives of each of the different governing bodies are delineated in the constitution of the denomination. For instance, the session of each church can choose its own pastor, but it must be confirmed by the presbytery. No group has authority over another group on its same level. For instance, one presbytery does not have authority over another presbytery. If both presbyteries belong to the same synod, appeals can be made to the synod. If they don't belong to the same synod, an appeal can be made to the General Assembly. In like manner, local sessions within a presbytery may appeal their case to the presbytery. The Presbyterian system differs from the Episcopal system in that there is only one level of clergy. There is only the teaching elder or pastor with no higher levels such as bishop. The Presbyterian system includes both the clergy and laity in the various governing bodies with no distinction made between the rights and powers of each one. A distinction is drawn, however, between a ruling elder, who would be a layperson, and a teaching elder, who would be a clergy member. One is hard-pressed to find such a distinction in the New Testament. While much of the teaching, the work of clergy, was done by the apostles, prophets, and evangelists, some of it was done by the ruling elders, as indicated in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 17, which states, "Let the elders who rule well be considered worthy of double honor, especially those who work hard at preaching and teaching." This verse indicates that ruling elders were involved in the task of teaching. as the years pass by and the apostles pass from the scene, there would be a need for authoritative teaching for which position the elders would assume. The Presbyterian system augments the need for leaders and the necessity for members of the church to submit to their leadership. Leadership is not viewed as a dictatorship, but as a biblical method ordained of God for the functioning of the church to which members are responsible. The power of the local church resides not in just one minister or elder who derives their power from the bishop, but it resides in a group of elders. The Presbyterian form of government also attempts to preserve the lordship of Christ by following his word and his will. Presbyterian systems also preserve the participation of the congregation. Individuals have direct access to God and the right to express their personal opinions. Finally, the Presbyterian system preserves the concept of corporateness, that is, each individual is seen as a part of the local body. While there are many strong points within the Presbyterian system of government, it is, as you might have guessed, not without its critics. Many object that the Presbyterian system is rooted in a hierarchy of governing bodies which really has very little scriptural support in the New Testament. Other than a group of elders, there is little evidence of higher bodies such as a presbytery or a synod or the General Assembly. In other words, Presbyterianism takes an inference from Hebrews chapter 13, verse 17, and 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 12, and raises that inference to the level of principle. Second, it is argued that the Presbyterian form of government does not give each individual believer an adequate part in the operation and function of church government. It takes power from the people and places it in the hands of a select few. Although in theory the presbytery and the session are supposed to be servants of the people, they may come to see themselves as rulers who lord it over others. Many decisions that should be referred to the entire church membership are not. So it is quite possible that the governing body, which is to represent the authority of individual believers, actually surpass that role and begin ruling despite its members. Finally, it is argued that the New Testament reveals much more of a blend of congregationalism and federalism than is seen in this system of governance. In other words, some want to see a greater balance between laity and clergy instead of ruling governing bodies. Now that we have discussed both the Episcopal and the Presbyterian systems of government, let's move on to the third and final system, that of congregationalism. Congregationalism stresses the role of the individual believer and makes the local congregation the seat of authority. There are two very important concepts that are basic to congregationalism: autonomy and democracy. Autonomy means that the local congregation is independent and self-governing with no external power above it, other than Christ, who is head of the church, to dictate decisions and courses of action. Democracy means that every member of the local congregation has a voice in the affairs and operation of the congregation. Authority is not the special privilege and right of a select few, but authority is located in the individual members of the congregation. Now, this doesn't mean that the entire congregation votes on every issue. That would be somewhat of micromanagement. But it does mean that decisions are made on a representative basis. The congregation may elect elders, deacons, and the like to represent them as officers of the church, but those officers are directly accountable to the congregation. If the congregation is not pleased with their performance, they can be voted out and removed. When an issue arises for a congregational vote, the elected official has one vote just like everyone else. Some of the major denominations that reflect this type of government include Baptist, Congregationalist, most Lutheran groups, and a great many independent churches. According to the adherents of Congregationalism, this form of government has its roots in the New Testament practice of church government. It's interesting how the adherents of each system claim this. In Acts and the Epistles, the primary focus is upon the local church itself, with no reference at all to any structure above or beyond it. There is not one instance of control over a local church by an outside organization or group of individuals. Sure, the apostles gave advice and they often made recommendations, but they exercised no real control. Paul, one of the greatest individuals in the New Testament, had to argue for his apostolic authority and beg his readers to follow his teachings in Galatians chapter 1, verses 11 through 24. Each congregation within the self-governing autonomous system calls its own pastor and determines its own budget. It purchases and owns its properties independently of any outside authorities. The local congregation may seek the advice from denominational officials or other churches, but it is not required to follow that advice or to seek ratification and approval from a hierarchy of officials. Just because a church is autonomous or independent of any external higher authority doesn't mean that they are independent of fellowship or don't have any other affiliations whatsoever. Don't confuse autonomy and self-rule with alienation and an unwillingness to associate with fellow believers and other organizations. On a voluntary basis, some autonomous congregations enter into cooperative affiliations that are beneficial to them for several reasons. First, it shows forth in a tangible way the type of unity that can exist within the larger context of churches and organizations outside of themselves. Second, these affiliations provide a greater degree of fellowship than is possible within one local congregation. This helps alleviate the potential problem of isolation. Third, cooperative affiliations allow for greater service and ministry than could otherwise be accomplished by one individual congregation. Missions, planning new churches, and youth activities are among several of the ministries that have been expanded and utilized with more effectiveness on a larger scale. Again, affiliation with such associations is on a purely voluntary basis. The local individual church can withdraw or terminate the relationship at any time if it so desires. The associations, conferences, and conventions formed by local churches also operate on a democratic basis. Voting is on a representational basis, usually in proportion to the size of the individual church. Although leaders within these affiliations bear titles such as president or executive secretary and fill the position for a specified time period, they are viewed as servants of the churches and not masters. In no sense of the word are they seen as bishops. Much of the democracy that exists within a local congregation is based upon the concept of the priesthood of all believers. Since every individual believer has the Holy Spirit indwelling them, he can lead and guide, and they don't have to depend upon a ruler. Since the work of Christ means that all believers have access to the throne of God, as Hebrews so clearly states, the principle of the priesthood of believers would be compromised if bishops or elders were given decision-making powers. The Apostle Paul himself even reminded us that every member of the body has a valuable contribution to make to the welfare and wholeness of the whole body. If leaders are to be involved in the church, they are to be elected by the free will of the congregation and held accountable to them. They are seen as servants of the congregation rather than rulers. As in the Presbyterian system, there is only one level of clergy in Congregationalism. The terms bishop, elder, and pastor are viewed as being synonymous. They mean the same thing. Or they are merely different functions or aspects of the ministry rather than different offices and levels of authority. It is interesting that when Paul was addressing the elders of Ephesus, we find an interchange of words. Acts chapter 20, verse 28 says, "Be on guard for yourselves and for all the flock, among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers, to shepherd the church of God which he purchased with his own blood." The word overseer is translated from the Greek term episkopoi, from where we get the word bishop. The word shepherd, or feed in some versions, is translated from the Greek word poimen, from where we get the word pastor or shepherd. According to Congregationalists, the use of all three terms in connection with the same group indicates equivalency. The office of deacon is considered a lay office and literally refers to one who serves. The adherents of this system advance several arguments for making this the New Testament norm for church government. As seen in the book of Acts, the congregation as a whole chose persons for office and determined policy. In Acts chapter 1, they chose Judas's successor. In Acts 6, they chose the first deacons. Although there is no explicit verse stating that the entire congregation was involved in appointing Paul and Barnabas to their work in Acts 13, one can draw that conclusion from the fact that when they returned to Antioch, they made their report to the whole church in Acts 14. In addition, it was the local congregation that sent Paul and Barnabas to Jerusalem to help settle the question of circumcision in Acts chapter 15. In response, the Jerusalem congregation, along with the apostles and elders, chose leading men from among them to send to Antioch with Paul and Barnabas. How do Congregationalists interpret clear passages which reveal the appointing of elders by the apostles instead of the whole church? Well, it could be that they were not actually chosen by the apostles. Maybe the apostles suggested the idea and presided over the ordination, but the choice was made by the people as occurred in Acts 6, with the choosing of the seven deacons. Some simply believe that since we no longer have apostles in the modern age, these examples should not be considered instructive for our day anyways. This is the end of number 6.